Hello. It's Sparkwood in 21. We're back. We are covering, obviously, the Showtime television series Twin Peaks. This is a No Ship Network podcast. I'm your host, Steve.
I'm your host, Paul.
And I am your host, Em. For those of you who are checking out No Ship Network for the first time, you can find out more about us and what else we cover at our website at noship.net. You can also find our content via the TV Time app, which is a free download for your smartphone. It provides podcast content, connects you to a worldwide community, and it notifies you when your television shows are coming on. We are discussing Twin Peaks, Part 3, Call for Help. And this was written by Mark Frost and David Lynch and directed by David Lynch. Any thoughts before we launch into recap?
Call for help.
Right. I agree. It's more of a, that's pretty much summarizes it. There's a lot going on in this episode. I watched it a few times and I can't wait to sit down with you guys and talk about it. So I think maybe I need help understanding a few things. So I'm excited. I enjoyed it. I thought it was fantastic. I mean, the first 20 minutes of it, I couldn't turn away from the screen, you know, so it's a good thing.
I felt so confident after we recorded our part one and part two podcast, like, oh man, we're pretty good at theorizing. And then I rewatched 3 and 4 and I'm like, oh, I don't know.
Right? Okay, good. That's how I feel. That's perfect.
The rope-a-dope strategy gets you feeling comfortable, mm-hmm. like you know what you're doing, and then we give you the real deal. Here you go. What do you think of this? I thought it was great. The visuals in part three, Call for Help especially, are just mm-hmm. amazing. And I think Em has already talked about it, and we've already talked about it before. The main criticism that people have of the new Twin Peaks is that it's going to appeal more to somebody who is a David Lynch fan rather than a Twin Peaks fan. And I think it's the most evident, at least in the first half of this episode, or this part, rather.
But don't you think that's one and the same, though?
Mm-hmm. Yes and no, because Twin Peaks is David Lynch, but no, because Twin Peaks is also Mark Frost.
Right.
So So the parts that people like this is a lot less Pie and Coffee and a lot more Lodge. Which mm-hmm. is
a lot more Fire Walk With Me.
Yeah, it's a lot more Fire Walk With Me, which is it's a great, great thing. But at the same time, there's people who really were attracted to Twin Peaks because of that small town kitsch factor, and mm-hmm. it is pretty much absent from this part. So
okay, but I got that. That was a good explanation.
What did you think?
Again, this was like part of my first viewing when we watched all 4 episodes, so it was all lumped together for me, and I enjoyed the entire experience. So I've been enjoying the show so far, and the thing I enjoy about it the most is, I guess because we're podcasting on it, I feel like I'm being what David Lynch wants me to be as a detective. That's so fun. I'm really enjoying it.
I really enjoy the way he kind of brings you down at the end of each episode with the music. You know, it's kind of soothing after you're wrecking your brain on what you think is going on or where it could possibly go. So it's kind of a nice touch. And then everything else, I mean, the storyline's fantastic. It's just, I need somebody to sit down and explain it to me.
Don't we all? Adult.
Which is why we're here, right?
We're just going to put our three blockheads together and figure it out.
That's right.
Coconuts.
So I would just like to remind everybody for the remainder of the podcast, please stay on the bike.
Okay, so this episode starts with Cooper falling through the in-between, which is looks like outer space. And then we get this shot of pinkish fluid where there's another infusion or injection of another more cloudy fluid into this clear pinkish purplish fluid. Did you guys catch that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Any thoughts on that? I want to brainstorm on that real quick, because that's got to be there for a reason, obviously.
I think it's the permeation of one dimension from one dimension into another. Like when you inject a fluid into like a new fluid or a different color fluid into something that's already being static, and you just shoot something in. And so it's like, so this is Cooper breaking through dimensional walls as he's going from place to place to place, which, and I don't know if these things are extra dimensional, intradimensional, or just extensions of the Lodge as we know it, you know, just kind of like Lynch really taking off with his reimagining of how expanse of the lodge can be, how much different it can be than what we've already seen with just the drapes and the chevron floors and the couches and statues. So I'm liking it either way, but I that's what I got from it, is kind of like that breaking of a barrier.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know how that in the future scene where she turns off that electric barrier thing? Mm-hmm. I kind of thought of the cloud part as him breaking through that on his own, and that's why it shows it. Like, it was some kind of, like, that part of the lodge is being protected from the rest of it. You know what I mean?
Interesting.
I don't know. It's just how I looked at it.
Well, the first thing I thought of, though, with the cloudy liquid coming into the more clear liquid is when somebody like injects themselves and a little bit of blood comes into the clear liquid.
Like the flow back.
I like that.
Cooper's now in this purple hued land, and I think Land may be generous in regards to describing this space. I don't know, because you really see like this just big body of water. There is a stark, unadorned, almost utilitarian building. And we see him first gazing over this large body of water, and the horizon looks like a giant bruise.
It does.
Right?
It does. Like, if you if you touch it, you're going to hear, like, you know, just this giant, ouch.
He then peers into the window and then opens it, and then he enters this dark room. The color inside reminds me of the color of Dorothy Valens' apartment in Blue Velvet. We see at first a blind woman, which she has, I guess, scar tissue over her eyes. And I don't know if this is supposed to be some sort of vulnerability. Because overall, I'm wondering if this is some sort of victim stronghold, because the woman that appears later after this woman falls off is Ronette Pulaski. Like, it's actually credited as Ronette Pulaski.
Which was really an interesting way to try to get her into it, because I knew that she was going to be a returning character. And I was thinking, okay, is she going to reprise her character? As you know, is Phoebe Augustine going to reprise her character of Ronette Pulaski and be there in Twin Peaks? I guess that could still happen, but I mean, this was a weird choice, but
yeah, and
not
you've got
a bad
the,
one.
You've got the protective mother that's banging, or I'm not sure if she's banging on a door, if she's stomping down a hallway. It sounds more like banging to me.
Yeah, I thought it was banging also.
I feel like in both scenes, that door was about to burst open from the inside. Like, whatever, it was something huge was, like, smashing it from the other side, because it had been locked by whoever was in the room at the time.
And the first woman, her time dimension seemed to be, like, of a different variant than the next woman, which is Ronette Pulaski, right?
Yeah. You know, I got the two different rooms. The first one reminds me of, like, if we're going to compare it to David Lynch works as Eraserhead, and then the second one reminds me of Mulholland Drive because of
the one that Ronette Pulaski's in.
Yeah. Because just the first one has that jitteriness and the fireplace is going. I think there's a fireplace in both, but, just the way that it is, that's what I got out of both. I don't know if it's really here or there, but
the first one was like the color of, like I said, Dorothy Valens color palette in her apartment from Blue Velvet, the like dried blood. And then the second one was deeper blues, but the couch that Ronette Pulaski was sitting in was blue velvet.
Literally blue velvet. Mm-hmm.
And then she was wearing red. So as far as what to make of that, exactly, I don't know. But it is the fact that Ronette Pulaski's there, you've got a protective mother, the sky looks like a bruise, you've got this very stark stronghold there. It seems like some sort of like castle with a moat around it that's protecting a princess inside.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it has anything to do with like a victim stronghold, like I already said before. So
yeah,
how it figures into the whole scheme of things, I don't know just yet.
Kind of like the dungeon for the Black Lodge,
or that, you know, maybe it's not a protective, maybe it is like a more like a dungeon where they're captured.
Yeah, and the mother is metaphor, you know, for the guard.
That's it. I never really thought of that as like as something to where these people are either being protected or held against their will.
Yeah.
Like they don't, it's like some sort of weird, like Black Lodge version of purgatory where
cause that whole switch throws everything off on it. You know what I mean? Like he tries to walk through and he can't, you know, and then she takes him up top, throws the switch, and then he goes back down. She disappears off into the universe or whatever that was. And then you come back down and she's there again. I mean, it has to do, and maybe that's the, you know, it's just whatever's keeping everything in.
Well,
you know what I mean?
Yeah,
the,
he goes
the
up.
Security.
Because first the number is 15. They go up. She pulls the switch.
Yeah.
And then they come back down and then the number's 3. So that had something to do with it as far as it being right or ripe for him to pass through. And then you also see the blue rose on the table as well.
Yeah. It's almost like it does. It just, for some reason, it just echoes to me as, because everything's filmed differently the first time around. Everything seems real choppy. She can't even speak back, you know, the way everybody else in the lodge is. And then the second time around, everything's back to normal for the lodge, which is weird that I could even say that now. And it's, I don't know. It just felt like a trap, like not like a trap, but like a prison, you know, because even when they're up top and it's making that noise, it sounds like water hitting a metal boat. You know, even though it's out in space, like almost a buoy. I don't know. This is where
you get into the weeds, and it's easy to get lost because you're just you're trying to interpret David Lynch's ideas and his visual concepts into normal, rational human thought, and it's not always the easiest thing in the world to do. We're all trying to figure it out together. We're all in this lifeboat. I like the TARDIS effect that was going on, though, because it was obviously a lot bigger on the inside, because you could see that whole thing as they were standing on it, and there was nothing underneath it directly that led into a bigger area. So when they go up that ladder and they're outside in space, they're not in vacuum, I guess, because, well, unless they're spiritual beings anyway, so it wouldn't matter.
But. Yeah.
Also, I do want to point out how the socket that hummed. It was almost like it was calling to Coop. Like, you know, like a telephone that has a light on it. We actually have one. When it rings, the light goes on too. So it's like, so you can find it in the dark, or if you have it on silent, you can see that it's ringing.
I figured the 15 was just military time for 3, right?
Well, we had 3:15 mentioned in the previous.
Oh, that's right.
So it was 15 first and then 3 later. And then 315 is his room number to the Great Northern, which we'll see later on his keychain or be reminded of that later.
Nice.
We also can't forget about Major Briggs.
Blue Rose.
Yeah.
That was awesome.
It's his head, which is missing from his body.
It's true.
Yeah.
I hate saying it out loud because I don't like the idea of Major Briggs being tortured, but.
Yeah.
The implication being he could be the body underneath the sheet. In Buckhorn.
Oh, shit. I didn't even think about that.
Even though it's been 25 years.
Yeah, we don't know if he
he's a time
got
traveler.
Killed in...
Yeah, he's a time traveler, possibly. And Bobby just said that there was a fire at the station. No talk about a body or anything like that. So, we'll see.
And then is the episode 4, that's the military, where they match the fingerprints, but it's blocked by the military.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, I'll hold on to that. That's really good. That's fantastic. That totally went over my head. That's genius.
Went over my head too. I wouldn't have thought of it at all.
No, that's fucking awesome.
Major Briggs, who's the only military character.
I see what you're saying, but I just didn't put the two together for some reason. I wasn't thinking along those lines because I was thinking that, you know, the military has the power to do that kind of stuff. I wasn't thinking like if they're protecting classified information, that could still be about a civilian. It doesn't have to be about a member of the military. So it didn't click to me that they can't access it because it's about a member of the military. So do you suppose Ronette Pulaski's mom is going to come in there after Coop is gone and be like, "So is this the sweetest smelling job you've ever had?" Wah, wah, wah.
I wonder if we'll have a follow-up scene to that at all. I hope we do. Because I thought that was... The first time I watched, I was so impressed with the artistic concept behind it. And it felt surreal and like, but it could really exist actually. Like, I don't know. I guess because it has like some sort of like mythic quality to it.
No, I agree. It had that stop animation feel to it also, you know what I mean, like the first go around. It was really, really well done.
When he tries to go out the 15, the first woman realized that he couldn't do that, so she was like gesturing quite emphatically to stop, like, and the gesture could be, you know, loosely interpreted as like, you know, head cut off, death, whatever, voguing. So that's when she brought him up, and then she hit the lever, and well, then she, I guess, is a sacrifice as a result, but now it's all changed down below and he can now exit out because it's now number 3.
It reminds me of a video game, kind of. And the way that, like, you know, you've played some video games, especially those older side-scrollers, where you would come into a certain room and there'd be certain things in the room, but once you hit a lever, everything in that room changed and you were able to go into it and it was something completely different.
Yeah, like a breaker.
Yeah, yeah. It's like you're hitting the breaker and it resets the whole thing. But I think it's significant that the first lady had to jump off and fall into the abyss so then he could go down the steps again, or the ladder again, rather, and see Ronette Pulaski there. And she was the one. So it's maybe it's the same spirit in different physical incarnations.
Mm-hmm.
And that would make a shitty, that'd be a shitty ending to that whole thing of Laura's sacrifice, because, you know, with, at the end of Fire Walk With Me, you see the angels and stuff like that. So I don't know. It kind of feels like there should have been, Ronette Pulaski survived, but then only to end up in this place instead of being able to either live out her life or then die and go to heaven as well.
Yeah, because you're referring to when she put on the ring, and that's her sacrifice. She made the call to go ahead and give up her life so Bob doesn't get her body.
Right.
Ronette Pulaski lives.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I'm referring to, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, one thing I want to say, I like how the nebula in the in between looks like a nighttime forest ablaze that the woman falls into.
Mm, nice. That's a cool way to look at it.
So, meanwhile, Mr. C is feeling under the weather. Oh, we forgot to mention 253. That's 250. The time. It was 252, but then 253 is what the evolved arm said.
Oh, that's right. Mm. Time and time again. Hmm.
So we see Mr. C, he's having a bad day because the time
is coming.
The time is coming, mm-hmm. So which is 253. So he's about to be taken into the lodge, presumably, yeah, right?
Exactly. He's getting woozy.
And so this is a time that he could get pulled in, and it's also the opportunity for Cooper to leave.
Finally come out.
Yeah. But Mr. C has a backup plan.
He's got a Dougie up his sleeve.
Yeah.
Dougie. This is how we Dougie.
Cooper gets zapped as he makes his approach towards the socket, and Ronette tells him that when he gets there, he will already be there. We hear electrical scratching on both sides, and this recalls the noise from the phonograph from part one.
Oh, yeah.
And then Ronette now tells Cooper that he better hurry. Her mother is coming. And that's what we learn what the source of the knocking is.
Mm-hmm.
Cooper finally exits, but he leaves his shoes behind, which makes me think of Wizard of Oz. Also makes me think of
new shoes.
New shoes, yeah. Because he's going to need new shoes. Except he won't get new shoes. He'll get Dougie shoes.
Yeah, Dougie shoes probably stink.
Probably. So he Mr. C is resisting the pull from the car lighter. He struggles under the stress, and eventually he crashes his car spectacularly, and red drapes begin to appear before him.
Thank goodness he wasn't trying to hold his puke while the car was flipping, because that wouldn't have been he wouldn't have been able to do that.
No go. No go at all. That would have just been like wide angle projectile spray.
Oh yeah, like a washing machine.
Ah.
And that didn't look like normal vomit. Ugh.
No, that was something else.
Yeah. It's dead livers or something.
This is where we see Dougie for the first time, who's another coop. And he's a pseudo coop, prop coop, decoy coop. And he's with Jade. So I'm wondering if we're ever going to see Emerald. And we also see that Dougie has the ring on, which has the petroglyph on it. And his left arm appears to be numb. So I think this brings a lot more information into what the ring is used for. Maybe brings up more conversation we can have at a later date about Teresa Banks.
Yeah.
And Laura herself. But this somehow marks Dougie as the one to be pulled into the Black Lodge in place of Bob.
It's almost like the ring wants to be in the lodge. So whenever the opening is there, whenever the time is right, if you're wearing the ring, you're going back. It's over. Or you're getting pulled into its sphere of influence at the very least.
It's like the ring of
power. Well, he didn't know. Yeah. And then so whatever they had inside of them, like the vomit, you know, that was important also, because he doesn't hold back and he gets the vomit out first, which to me gave him the, like, like maybe they had something inside of them that was keeping them from going back to the lodge, and then whoever got it out first was guaranteed to go. Because Mr. C's really holding it in, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then finally, when he realizes it's all over, he gives up all the, you know, all the vomit and everything still comes out, but he's so exhausted trying to hold it in that he doesn't go, you know, or he just passes out.
That's an interesting interpretation of that. I didn't think of it like that.
Mm-hmm. Because Mr. C is vomiting, there's some black bile shit in there that you said looks like a liver, which you're
yeah, black and yellow.
It's cream awful. Corn,
but
I think.
The yellow was the cream corn. That's the Garmin Bosia from the Pain and Sorrow from the movie. Mm. And so I don't know why he would have to get the Garmin Bosia out to make sure that he didn't go back in, but maybe that's one of the things that, like, kind of tags him as somebody who needs to, you know, that it's like, if you can get that out of you, or no, if you could keep it in you until the moment has passed, then you puke it up and then you can, you're safe, I guess.
Yeah.
But he seemed to lose something after he puked that Garmin Bosia. And we'll talk more about that in the next part, but he's not as bad as the real Cooper, but there's something that's not quite clicking up here. The way he talks, his mannerisms, the way he repeats himself. So
yeah,
I did think of my cats though when Dougie vomited onto the carpet.
Right. Thank goodness he didn't do the hairball. That would have been awful. It was a very quick, you know, he pukes and then disappears in the poor prostitute. It sounded like a gunshot went off.
Like she's a sonic boom.
Yeah. She's like, "What's going on?" And then just goes back to her shower. I mean, I hear that kind of mess. I'm going to run out, but she, you know, she's busy.
But I noted here, because it's been a while since I wrote these notes, that Mr. C vomits a mix of cream corn, blood, and sludge. Was this Dougie he was vomiting? I know, crazy question, but the way it was edited promotes me to ask. So there was something as far as the editing that was trying to direct you towards the vomit for some reason. So I think I like your interpretation better. I don't think he's... But...
Dougie also vomits, though, too.
Yeah.
And but Dougie gets it out first, though.
Yeah.
And then goes in. Mr. C doesn't let it out until he sees Dougie sitting in the chair and going off into the Black Lodge. And then he finally goes, okay, the plan worked, and just lets out his own vomit and brain matter or whatever the fuck that was. You know, poop. I don't know.
A little bit of everything.
It's like somehow the cream corn keeps you tethered to this particular dimension or something.
It's possible. Yeah, whatever they've got going on. Maybe they both have that little golden pearl inside of them. I don't know. And that's what's protecting it. I have no idea. You know, it's definitely a possibility. And it's almost like Dougie was the glutton version of Cooper. You know what I mean? Like, you've got the evil version, and then they make a clone or whatever he is out of, like, another part of, like, the gluttony side. 'Cause he's kind of heavyweight. He's into prostitutes. You know, he owes people money. You know, so he's kind of like the third version, because we all have a little bit of that in us. So
he's an embodiment instead of just being, you know, a balanced person who has a little bit of this, a little bit of that. He's the embodiment of greed and lust and sloth, and all of these things.
Kind of like they took that out of Mr. C. You know what I mean? Whoever helped make it, they got the ring, used it to make another doppelganger, but instead. It's not like you can't take the good out of them or the evil out of them. So maybe they took the gluttony version and, you know, the greedy version out of them.
Yeah, they split. So you've got just like the dark violence within Mr. C, and you've got the lust in Doug.
Exactly, the lust and the greed. Because Mr. C, you know, it's not like he's rocking any kind of jewelry. He's got a couple nice cars, but that's not that big of a deal. He might just want something reliable.
Yeah.
So it's... It's like they took that part out of him to make old Dougie Doug.
I like that. Because I didn't think about it before, but it makes sense because he has all of those attributes. Like you said, he is, you know, he is overweight. He's with the prostitute and he owes money. He's in Vegas.
Garish clothing.
Sin City.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
So now we've got Dougie in the lodge. And he sits before Mike, and Mike says, "Someone manufactured you for a purpose, and now I think that's been fulfilled." Dougie's hand begins to shrink, and the ring falls off. And I've already mentioned that ring marked him somehow.
Oh, for sure.
Dougie's head begins to shrink. I really love Kyle MacLachlan's acting here, because he looks perplexed as to what's happening to him.
I know. You feel bad for him. It's like, oh, Dougie, I'm sorry.
He's getting the Beetlejuice treatment, you know?
Yeah.
He's like, hey, wait a minute. What's going on? What's going on?
Then his head pops into a black smokestack or
At first,
well, it's kind of the opposite of what Laura was. You know, they pull off the mask and Laura has a bunch of energy. And now that Dougie, something unnatural and a doppelganger, it's not really the real person. He's like a dark mask.
Carbon cloud.
You know what I mean?
Like a negative.
Yeah, and then it shrinks down and it looks like a black piece of the arm's head, the chewing gum thing.
Yeah.
It looked like that, but a rotten version.
Yeah.
It was interesting.
It started having purulence or something come out of it.
Yeah.
Excretions. And so, you know, what you're describing, you know, Mike's watching incredulous and there's a lot that happens because first you see the gold ball and then all of a sudden it's like it develops this encasing shell around it, which is either charred flesh, charred something, or stone. And then it starts to excrete and then it's like the gold ball escapes and then charges at it and it's electrical charges happen and then all we're left with is the ring and the ball.
Mm-hmm.
I prefer to think of it as a kernel, a small little gold kernel of Garmin Bosia.
Good with that.
Okay.
I mean, I'm just throwing it out there. I don't know if I'm going to stick with that, but that's just
concentrated.
It is in a ball shape though, so it's not really a kernel shape. They could have made it look like a solid gold kernel, and that would have been more direct if that's what they were going for. So that's probably not.
It's new information, whatever it is, and I have no idea what to make of it. So I'm just gonna reserve my judgment on that for now.
Mike seems to think it's important enough to hold on to it, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, put it in his little pocket.
Yep. He's like, I'm gonna save this for later.
And he places the ring on the Formica table. Cooper is emitted into the room that Dougie once inhabited. Jade stumbles upon him, is surprised at his change.
You know, the Jade finding him like this, and in the next part, his wife seeing him like he is, with the haircut and the lost weight and the just looking like a completely different person, they really just don't have enough reaction for me to you know, that would just be like, that it's, you can't pull that off. Like, at least with his wife, there was 3 days. With Jade, she just saw him before she got into the shower, and then she comes back and she's like, oh, look at you. You look better. You know, but you're lying on the floor next to some poo. So, you know, get up and let's get out of here because this isn't your house, you know.
Well, it shows you that they don't actually care about him. You know,
that's true.
She's just, she sees technically the same person. You know, it's not, it would be like a double, you know, and his wife, I mean, we'll get to her when the time comes, you know, so.
But you're saying both of those women don't care about Dougie?
No, not at all.
Yeah.
Mm-mm. If they even exist.
Oh, and that's a good point, too.
We're about to get to that.
Well, I mean, great. All of this stuff is weird. And but Jade, who's named after a television character from Invitation to Love, which is already suspect, she at least does recognize there is some personality change in Dougie, where Janie doesn't. But we'll get into that when we get there. But
hold on a second. If Jade is a character from the show and that is an indication that she's not real, isn't Chet a character on the show as well?
Yes.
So Chet Desmond is not real. We'll dig into that some other time. Just throwing it out there.
Well, I'll give her she figures that he's had a stroke because he has the tingly left arm, you know, the numbness in his arm. So I think that's why she realizes something's happened. She's just like, get the fuck out. Go find help.
I'm not taking care of you, bud.
Mm-hmm, exactly, because she's made her money. Obviously, he paid beforehand. So, but I give her that she's like, okay, you've had some kind of stroke. You need to go find help. You know.
Yeah.
So I'll give her a little bit more than the wife. But the wife, I mean, there's something weird going on there.
Yeah.
She might have been a plant to begin with, anyway.
Yeah. And Em's got a pretty interesting theory here too.
It's not a well thought out theory. I just have some, like, there's just some flagposts that are popping up that I think are pointing us towards something. I just think this is a dream, or he's inside Mr. C. He's not actually in our world yet, so he's only like gotten halfway to where he needs to be, and that's why one of them has to die. So one of them has to fully inhabit Cooper's body.
Ooh, interesting. Okay. Okay, it's interesting.
But the reasons why are pretty neat, though.
Yeah, I can't wait. We're going to wait. Are we waiting until we get to that part?
Well, I mean, it's all coming up pretty quickly here.
Sweet.
So it becomes something other than, it becomes apparent that something other than Cooper's shoes are missing. And as we move on, we see that he still has his room 315 key to the Great Northern. There are men tracking Dougie. And this immediately makes me recall Mulholland Drive, because Betty slash Diane, if you know, if you believe this interpretation of the film, most of it's a dream. In her dream, she dreams of these an inept hired assassin who's not good at his job, so she can kind of like comfort herself with the idea that what she actually did in real life didn't succeed, yeah. Right?
Huh.
So these guys remind me of that inept assassin who went to that building, shot through the wall, hit the woman in the butt, and had to shoot the janitor, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, as they're driving through out of this suburb that's mostly seems uninhabited. It kind of reminds me of the suburb from Arrested Development that they were trying to.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Some kind of subdivision that's being built.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. It's very, like, all the houses, like when they build all the fucking houses, but there's no one to live in them yet, you know?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And then they see.
We see it around here all the time.
And then they see the sign for Sycamore Street. This catches Cooper's attention. And this is when I first started going, man, I think this is a dream. Because, I mean, what are the odds of that? So now you see this woman and her son in this house. The woman is doing drugs. She's got whiskey. She says 119, 119, which is 911 backwards.
Mm-hmm.
And she takes this pill like it's for the last time. Like what she's deciding to do is significant, yeah. And like some sort of like life or death type of thing. And she takes it with whiskey. There's a deflated red balloon behind her. And then there's her son. So I just immediately thought of the movie The Red Balloon. Don't know if that necessarily has anything to do with it, but I looked up the film, which I haven't seen, but the film does suggest that irrational violence and aggression are innate to mankind and questions the way modern society appears to condone and reinforce feelings of xenophobia, alienation, discrimination, and antagonism.
So it's all real uplifting stuff.
Yeah.
I haven't seen the movie, like I said, but there's a boy who has a red balloon that follows him around. Apparently, the movie is only 35 minutes long, so I am going to do some homework, yeah. And I'm going to watch it this weekend.
I've seen it. It's I saw it as a teenager, I think, in one of our classes. It's interesting. It's a short film, right?
Yes, 35 minutes long.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there's a
go
girl
ahead.
Who also has a balloon that follows her around. He encounters, and hers is blue.
I don't remember the girl, but it's interesting. I didn't even see the red balloon in the room. I was too busy looking at what all was on the table.
Yeah, like what?
And then the little kid seeing that guy plant the bomb underneath the car.
This poor kid.
I've got a small theory on all of it, but it's probably too. For me, it's probably too straightforward. You know what I mean? Like whoever helped Mr. C create old Doug knows that one of them has to die to go. For Mr. C to stay outside of the lodge. So those guys were hired to kill Coop when he came out. You know what I mean? Because they were planning on him to come through. Even the woman across the street makes sense, because that would be Mr. C's backup plan to kind of look out. It's his people to keep an eye across the street. And that the pill and the whiskey was just her reward, because he's got her hooked on her own demon. So it's just kind of like, you know, she's not going to go anywhere. And he might have even tainted her with some of the lodge in itself. You know what I mean? So I just looked at it as part of the plan to make sure that Coop stays out. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes perfect sense, actually. If those guys are hitmen that were hired by Mr. C, like you said, to make sure that if all else failed, like if he had taken off the ring for some reason and he didn't end up in the lodge, like if he's watching those curtains in the car trying not to puke and he doesn't see anybody in that chair, then he's like, oh, shit. Well, then he has to wait for those guys to kill him.
Which is why they're covering the basis on the vehicle too, which could come back later to mess something up. I just thought the little kid was gonna go grab the bomb himself and play with it, but I like the idea of it not being real because of the way Mr. C's acting in episode 4, which I know I shouldn't even bring it up, but it's a cool way to look at it. I think they both work really well, especially with it being fake would explain a lot of the weird stuff that's going on. Even when he gets to the casino, you know, no, they're not going to ever let him leave that casino after pulling 28 straight jackpots off of the machines. They would keep his ass there for cheating or something. They would grill him for a while other than just handing him a bag of money. So it explains a lot of the other things that went on too, it being not being really being a dream. It's really cool. I like it.
Yeah, and I mean, in the 119, that's 911 backwards, and it's like a mirrored reality, like on the other side of the looking glass.
Yeah.
I don't know what it, you know, it's still even like you kind of land on things like that, like, oh, I think I got something. You still don't really understand. So just kind of like,
no,
just
that's let it wash like over hearing... you
and hopefully it all settle down somewhere in my brain and
yeah,
make sense.
I can't wait till we get to listener feedback and hear some of our listeners' ideas on it. I like the different theories. It makes it easier. You know what
I mean? Yeah, it really does. Well, it really does, because some of the shit is flying over my head like a 747.
It's supposed to.
But I'm getting some of it. I'm getting enough of it for it to be super enjoyable. That's not the issue.
It's the whole point. This is a journey.
Yeah, for sure.
We're supposed to be sitting down here trying to figure stuff out. It's an interactive experience with television.
Interactive television.
Yeah. That's why David Lynch is fun. We're not just sitting here like lumps and having shit spoon-fed to us. We have to interact and participate.
He'll make it 4D because we'll get to scratch and sniff Black Lodge for episode 5 and 6. I'm kidding.
That would be awesome.
Right.
Welcome to Notion Network.
As long as it doesn't smell like whatever landed in Mr. C's car.
Right. Ugh. Oof.
Okay, so... we get a quick scene where the highway patrol encounters Mr. C's car and they're gagging and doubling over from the smell, which I wondered, what does it smell like? Not that I really want to know, but if they could just give a description, does it smell like engine oil, burnt engine oil?
Old hot cream corn.
And probably some freaking really harsh chemical that we don't know anything about. Haloperidol, whoa, maybe. Who knows?
Ammonia,
yeah.
Penis pants.
Ugh.
Cat piss and drain cleaner.
Yeah.
Ugh.
So Twin Peaks, we're at the Twin Peaks Sheriff's Department. Hawk places a donut disturb sign on the door. Today is National Donut Day, by the way.
Today is National Donut Day. Damn it. Well, The day's not over. I can still go get donuts later.
And that means you can get them for free.
Nice.
Usually from Dunkin' Donuts and places like that, you can go and they will give, if you buy a cup of coffee, they will give you a free donut. I've done it before.
That's awesome.
There's also National Coffee Day, and you can do the same thing. Go buy a donut and you'll get a free cup of coffee.
Nice.
Okay, so Andy and Lucy are looking over all of the evidence and they say they can't find what is missing. Hawk says, if it's not here, how do you know it's missing? And this gets pretty confusing for everybody in the room. And then Lucy says, but if it is here, it isn't missing. I do, by the way, want to point out there's a double R to go box on the table, which is funny.
Oh, nice.
So eventually Lucy starts to freak out because she has to admit that she ate one of the chocolate bunnies because she had a gas bubble back in the day. And she read somewhere that indigenous people ate it as a remedy for gas bubbles.
What I liked about this scene was that she says, I don't like to talk about this in front of Andy, but I had gas. And then you look over at Andy and he's disgusted. He's just like, oh, I really don't want to be hearing about this.
Deputy Hawk is the most patient man in the building for sure, because
yes,
I probably would have ended up axe kicking that table and just pushing everything out whenever she would start talking about the bunny and just left. I mean, it's a hard room to get help from, you know.
Yeah, you are barking up the wrong tree, Hawk.
And he does even question whether, because he's like, it's not about the bunny, but he's like, wait. Is it about the bunny?
Right.
No, it's not about the bunny.
And then I like it because he's like, he questions her, you ate evidence? Like, have you done this before? You know, do we need to worry about you putting things in your mouth?
So next we get to see what Jacoby's doing with the shovels. And he's got this awesome contraption, this lever pulley contraption, where he's got the shovels hanging so he can move them with a pedal and keep them free of any sort of...
Debris,
yeah, or it's genius.
Obstruction when he's spray painting them.
So,
and it's perfect because it's really hard to spray paint and not get like contaminants in it. And then to hang them like that, and he, you know, there weren't any streaks. It was really evenly painted all over. He can paint some shovels. That's all I'm saying.
Now he's painting them either gold or yellow, right?
Gold
for sure.
All right, so let's talk about the color yellow or gold or whichever. But consider them both together in this episode. We have Jacoby's gold diggers, right? Then we have we have the gold ball that
the gold ball
that Dougie became. We have Dougie's yellow coat, which is looked disgusting mustard color.
It was green. It was like a... Oh, is it the first coat? The first coat was gold. You're right.
Yes, the first coat was gold.
We have Jade's Jeep, which is a bright, bright canary yellow.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have the Silver Mustang Casino, which Cooper gets dropped off at a little later on. And
gold sign.
It's the it's not yellow on the outside, but you see in part four, their little insignia or whatever, their logo, I guess, has it's gold and it has horseshoes in it. So there's a lot going on with the color yellow here, and I do not know what the significance is.
The first time I noticed it, though, was part two, Mr. C's bathroom in the hotel room when he killed Daria. Because I was like, wow, you never really see yellow in Twin Peaks.
Yeah, and now you're seeing a lot of it.
Hmm.
So for some reason, that bathroom was just like bathed in yellow.
So I think the fact that Jacoby is painting these shovels this color is letting us know that we need to look at this color and start digging and
I like that.
Get to the point. You know, try to solve the mystery from that way. I think Jacoby's going to be this outside indicator of what the viewer needs to be doing.
Follow the yellow brick road. Oh, follow the yellow brick road.
The yellow brick road. And the shoes, good one. Yeah. We're figuring you out, Lynch, inch by inch.
Maybe.
Maybe.
Hopefully.
Yeah, kind of.
There is only one flaw in the way that he's painting that. Wherever that rope's holding,
I thought of that.
The shovels wouldn't get painted. He would have to somehow. He could probably hang it by the
reverse it.
Yeah.
When they dry.
Yeah. Or you can just go with a paintbrush later. It would just be a small surface area.
Yeah. Jacoby just went, duh.
Yeah. I've already got it figured out.
Or he's got different plans for that end.
Oh.
So now Jay drops off Coop at a casino. She gives him $5 to call for help. Jade says, you can go out now. And he recalls Laura saying, you can go out now from the lodge. And then we have a...
She tells him to call someone for help, like you mentioned. Mm-hmm. So this is where we get the phrase, the name and the title, and it gets repeated a lot. Rewatches kind of give you a good comedic effect for this. Mm-hmm. Call for help.
I wanted to hug him so much. Poor Coop.
I know.
Yeah, and we see him struggle with the revolving door and that damn guard, the first guard. What the hell? And
he didn't care.
He's this guy's path of least resistance, dude. He wants to do the bare minimum at work and still get paid. Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, he looks at his job as a Walmart greeter kind of deal.
Yeah.
Then again, you know, we want to help Coop because we love Coop. This guy probably sees some shit though, being a guard at the front of a casino. Mm-hmm. You probably see all kinds of things on an everyday basis, and you can't stop to help every crazy person who tries to come in to win their fortune at the slot machine.
All right. Yeah. I'll grant him that.
Yeah. All right. But after that's all we give him.
I still hated him. And then the next guy is even worse because obviously Cooper needs help. He even says, call for help. And the guy directs him toward the back. And when Cooper doesn't even go exactly in the direction that he vaguely gestured towards, he yells, hey, in this really rude way. And then he directs him towards the window.
Yeah, he kind of jerks him like, hey,
yeah,
go over there.
Where he needs to go exchange his $5 for those tokens or whatever they are. And the woman who gives him the token, she looks very concerned, but she doesn't act on it.
Yeah. She's been in a lot of stuff. I don't know if you guys recognized her, but she has been in a lot. She was in, this is dating me, but Masters of the Universe, 1987. I think she was Evelyn was her name.
The live one?
She's been, what?
The live action one with Dolph Lundgren?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Oh. She was in that movie. She was a major character. She's been in a ton of stuff. I thought she was in V, but she wasn't. But she's been in a lot of different things. It's interesting that I haven't seen her in a while, and then she shows up as just cashier.
I looked her up
at the end of the episode.
Breaking Bad, and she was the crackhead couple where the...
Oh, they had the...
The vending machine.
The vending machine in their house.
Yeah. Or no, it was ATM machine. The ATM machine.
ATM machine.
They sold that entire... And they had that little kid that was living there.
It's possible. It's possible. I mean, I looked up a little bit. She was in like Hawaii 5-0, the old one. I mean, it was like... She's done stuff since like 74, I think, or 73. It was impressive, but it was just interesting to see her in there. I instantly recognize her. It's her eyes, but this has nothing to do with the podcast. I'm kind of derailing a little bit, so it's just interesting.
So Cooper starts to notice this triangular-shaped image, which is the drapes, the chevron floor, and it's wreathed in flames, and it guides him on his Midas-like journey through the slot machines. We have this Cretan-like woman who's crazy-haired, greasy. She probably hasn't been home in years. And
Yeah, for sure. She's homeless.
She at first looks at Cooper with avarice,
mm-hmm.
tainted with heavy malice.
Oh, yeah.
And he points to her, like, he points at a slot machine for her, and she just gives him the finger and says no. And he then sees the burning symbol again, and he's actually, he sees the symbol above many sheens at this point, and this Cretan woman sees that he's succeeding on other machines, and then she goes and tries the machine he gestured towards, and she finds out that she, and then she gets jackpot.
Yeah, and then she starts realizing, oh, this guy's a moneymaker.
Now she loves him.
First mm-hmm. he was
slot machine junkie.
Nutcake, and now she loves him.
Oh, yeah. She's the one who calls him Mr. Jackpot, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Now, what do you think? Do you think it's the lodge guiding him to where he needs to go? Like, the money's going to help facilitate him get back to Twin Peaks? Or do you think it's... Because it sounds like they... You know, later on they tell him that he needs to die, or one of them needs to. So what? Why is the lodge helping him?
I think the
That's
lodge.
The question I had.
I took it as the lodge is trying to restore the natural order. Like, it's mm-hmm. supposed to be that Mr. C goes back and Cooper goes yeah. out. You know, so they're both out to a certain degree. We're not really sure how much Cooper's out, but we know how much Mr. C is out. So that all that remains mm-hmm. to be kind of sussed out later on. But I think the lodge is it's trying to, what is it called, homeostasis?
Achieve balance.
Yeah, to mm-hmm. achieve that yeah. balance and to get him out. So it's doing, I think you're right. I think it's trying to, the money could facilitate him getting back to where he needs to be, whether that's Twin Peaks or somewhere else. Hopefully Twin Peaks. But yeah, I think
well,
that's what's going on.
If you go with M's theory, I kind of like it to where outside of, like in the real world, everything's going wrong for Mr. C. He ends up in prison. And if Cooper's inside like a dreamlike state, then of course in a dream you're going to pull, what was it, 29 jackpots?
29. So that,
30
yeah.
total.
Well, 30
end.
Because.
30 total jackpots well, the, that he hit.
The 30th one was hers because they were like, how yeah. many has he done? And then okay. he points and then she hits jackpot. So they're like, that's yeah. 30.
So I would kind of go along with your theory.
Well, yeah. And also, I don't know if this has anything to do with it. And it's not as strong as what you guys are suggesting. But Cooper in the original series, like he was a perfect shot. You know, he was just
oh, yeah.
a person who could do everything really well. He was very lucky for the most part. So mm-hmm. why wouldn't he also be here? But I mean, I guess something else is guiding him
yeah.
that we can actually see. I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, he is pretty much like, if you're going to be good, right? Kind of like babies are naturally good because they don't have anything to corrupt them yet. You know what I mean? Like everybody thinks that if a baby passes, it's automatically going to go to heaven because it hasn't had a chance to do anything wrong. So with Coop being like the childlike version of himself, like as good as you can be, it's kind of like what Coop is because everything else has been stripped from him. So it would make sense that natural, the luck of his could be magnified by it. You know what I mean? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. No? I see what you're saying. It's kind of like the innocent natural state, and he's able to just mm-hmm. because it's not greed, it's not anything mm-hmm. else. It's just like, oh, hello, I'm just pulling the lever, you know, and then yeah. all the money comes out. So yeah. because it's, you know, so but then you have the element of the little flaming piece
the
of the lodge
thing for sure,
like telling him which one to go to. So if he goes to the wrong one, it's not going to happen. Apparently, mm-hmm. at least that's what I'm getting out of it.
Yeah. I don't know.
I don't either.
I know. We're just guessing.
That's three really good yeah. ideas, though. We'll probably get some feedback and I'll go, okay, that makes I like that.
That sounds better.
So now we're in Philadelphia at FBI headquarters, and we've got Gordon Cole, Albert Rosenfield, and Agent Tamara Preston. And this scene, I think, is probably like, you know, got like three parts in a way. The first is David Lynch, I think, playing on the idea of us viewers, because you got all these detectives around the table and they're supposed to be investigating this particular crime, and all the clues laid out in front of them is supposed to be the key to the solution. And it's all these like, or it's like a random selection of things that you wouldn't think would actually go together. You've got sex, violence, time of innocence, and various other things that are
some beans
represented. Yeah. And then you got the beans, which is like the random quirk that's going to get, you know, injected into the whole.
Well, I figured out who did the killing. It was a farmer pervert who likes Uzis and grows beans. And he likes to sail because when he was a child, he had a little sailor suit on. So there you go.
Problem solved.
Case solved.
Sailboat's his rosebud.
Right? Right.
So that's short. They end that he dispatches all those agents with the exception of Albert and Tamara. And so now it's left up to Tamara, who is TP, who was the investigator in the secret history of Twin Peaks. She gives Albert and Gordon the skinny on what happened to Tracy and Sam, or at least what they know up until now. And man, those photos, like you mentioned them being cat scratched to death, that had to go for a while because the results are alarming. I'm pretty sure their brains were scooped out or something, or they melted. Yeah, or
and you don't see any bone. Yeah, it's like they sucked the head out and kind of left a gloppy skin sack. It's fucking disgusting.
I was going to say, whatever anonymous billionaire built this thing to photograph all this stuff needs to just seal it up. Because whatever that thing is now loose in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So who knows when it's going to show up again or what it's going to do.
And it was interesting that it only showed like a quick photo of it. And then when it moved, it was gone. It didn't show it the glass being broken. Remember, right. it turned dark. It just showed the basic outline. And then it was also interesting, too, that whoever owned the millionaire, billionaire, whoever owns the building didn't come to collect their photos. You know what I mean? So like you said, whenever it kind of just dawned on me that might have just been the whole plan was to release that thing out into the world. You know what I mean? Instead of collecting data, maybe it was just a final, let's get this evil creature out.
Well, also there was no photos of Cooper, which appeared exactly prior to that creature, Lemurian. Possibly. Mm-hmm. I don't.
Yeah. Why would the photos of Cooper not shown up? Why would they not?
Well, he might have been. I mean, we don't know what Cooper was at that time. You know what I mean? Like, it's to me, Cooper is a completely different being. You know, like when they were trying to draw that thing there, it was kind of like bringing it into existence, kind of like the way Cooper went through the electrical outlet. It's kind of like what they did with the sex or whatever happened that made it come together and bust through the cage itself. You know what I mean? So Coop might have just been a gas or whatever he was in the Black Lodge, and it wouldn't have shown up anyway. We were privy to seeing it, but maybe those cameras weren't able to take a picture of Coop because he wasn't drawn into it. He just kind of like put there and then he left. You know what I mean? Mm.
Well, it's like the glass became permeable and he was able to kind of like melt into it like a gas or kind of like that shot we saw at the beginning of this episode with the injection. But maybe it's possible that whoever owns the building got there before the law enforcement and was able to remove whatever memory cards they wanted and left exactly what they wanted to leave behind.
Mm. See, I like that. I like that they had their security guards come in real quick, pull out what they needed, and then call the FBI in, or the cops. I like it.
Well, and the security guards are all missing. All of them, not just
the
one.
Yeah, well, there's no records, though. You know what I mean? That's the thing. They don't know who owns it, so how do they know who was working there?
Yeah.
Just there's no security guards in the building. It's genius. Somebody's rich if they can buy a building in New York City.
And hide the ownership of it.
Hide the ownership, not care what happens to it. Crazy.
So next, Gordon gets a call about Cooper, and he announces to Albert that they will be heading to the Black Hills of South Dakota. Albert is enthused, as usual, and Agent Tamara Preston will be joining them as well. And this is the end of the episode before, you know, we get to the band, so
Yeah, Albert doesn't really seem to be. He makes a joke about getting a truckload of Valium. He's not super enthused about going to the Black Hills. I mean, I think he wants to do whatever he can in his power to help Coop and help, you know, get to the bottom of whatever the situation is, because that's obviously big news. But
yeah,
who really is just chomping at the bit? Oh, South Dakota. I was waiting. You know, I haven't been in so long that, you know, it's one of the, I'm sure that South Dakota is lovely, but, you know, I heard it is. If you don't live there, it's one of those cliche places that people always refer to as like flyover, you know, places to where it's just made fun of. I've lived in a place like that, but it's a hidden secret. You just, you know, people don't know that they're really actually great places to live. So, but
for sure. I think Sturgis is in South Dakota. So you got like motorcycle rallies and different things out there. But yeah, I've never had it on my radar of stops.
Destinations.
Other than the presidential
Rushmore.
Fuck, what's it called? Yes, thank you. Other than Mount Rushmore, you know, that would be cool to see.
Yeah, I'd love to see Mount Rushmore.
It's all they're also in the process of making the Crazy Horse Monument. That's also supposed to be really cool.
Very cool.
I know somebody who's actually ridden their bikes past it, and it's like one of those things you have to see in person. Obviously, like, it's immense.
Awesome.
So everybody who wrote in feedback, we're commenting on both parts 3 and 4. So we're going to save those for the end of part 4. But John Bernardi did send a sound file for both parts. So we're going to go ahead and leave you with John Bernardi's sound file. John Bernardi has been contributing to our podcast for a couple of years now.
Oh, at least, yeah.
And he's also started his own blog, which I will share a link to that in our show notes, as well as a link to the website 25yearslatersite.com, because he also writes for them as well, which they focus on Twin Peaks exclusively. 25 Years Later Site is a new Twin Peaks site filled with theories, analysis, reviews and of books and podcasts, interviews, and much more. So check it out. Without further ado, John Bernardi.
Em, it's 11:30 on a sunny Friday morning, and I've been thinking a lot about the color purple. Not the movie, but the place somehow under the lodge by the primordial-looking sea that reminds me of the end of Evangelion. As that sea was at the beginning of another world, I tend to agree with the public at large that this is a rebirth metaphor for both Twin Peaks and for our special agent Cooper. But a quick circle back to that color. My beautiful wife was looking through the secret history the other day and came up with Dr. Jacoby's reference to the color purple. It turns out his multicolored glasses that give him his balance also gives this balanced world of his a purple hue. Seems like this power station or whatever it is a place of perfect balance between the lodges, perhaps. And maybe at that point of perfect balance is the only place you're allowed to leave from. As far as Cooper's wits, I've heard it said that McLaughlin's playing it as a character affected by dementia, an idea I have no interest in arguing with, and I think his shoes are the toehold Coop needs to be able to leave the lodge at all. There can be two Coopers in the world, because one's only halfway there, and his soul's fragmented until a certain shoe salesman comes back to our world to deliver our Cooper his missing pieces. After all, the uniform has always been an important relation to Cooper's abilities. Once Cooper finds enough of himself, drinks enough coffee, and gets his shoes back, I bet any money that's when we first hear a saxophone. Take care, you Eagle Scouts. I'll see you in episode 4.
So, John, I would just like to say that thank you for once again giving us a sound file and calling us Eagle Scouts. I thought you might like to be interested in knowing, or I thought you would be interested in knowing that Paul is actually literally an Eagle Scout. So,
thank you very much.
There you go. Now what you're saying is actually true instead of just being complimentary to us. So it's awesome. I really like what you said about the uniform and the shoes, him missing the shoes and getting a pair of new shoes from the
salesman.
Everybody's favorite one-arm shoe salesman.
Yeah, I gasped when you said that, John.
That is spot on, as they say, spot on.
Yeah, and then also bringing up Jacoby's blue and red glasses. Mm-hmm. I did think about the color purple being a mixture of red and blue, but I didn't think about the secret history of Twin Peaks or the idea of it being a balance. So that's interesting that would be, it felt like a violent world, or there was like a threat there and that Cooper was an irritant in it. So when I think of balance, I think of harmony. So I'm not arguing with that idea, because, you know, balance could probably be within that particular universe a completely different expression than what I'm used to.
And also, if you're correct about the color purple being that middle ground between the two different lodges, and that's the place where you can exit, it would make sense that anything that was in there that didn't belong was an irritant and was being, pushed out.
Expelled.
Yeah.
Yeah, expelled. So just, that's the whole reason. It's like it's just kind of like all
disturbing
of
disturbing the balance.
Everything that lives there is like a white blood cell trying to get you out because you don't belong there. You could go to the dark side, you can go to the light side, but you're not staying here.
I see. I like that.
I like that too.
Very cool. And thank you so much for that sound file. You speak very well.
I know, right?
Yeah, it's a nice.
It was wonderful.
Yeah, it's a nice addition to our podcast. So I look forward to hearing more. All right, so that's it for part three.
Join us very soon for part four. This has been a No Ship Network podcast. I'm your host, Steve.
I'm your host, Paul.
And I am your host, Em.
We mean it like it is.
Like it sounds.
Is this thing on?
Call for help.